and welcome to Something's Off with Andrew Heaton. I'm your host, Andrew Heaton. I am 85% Andrew Heaton. And today we're going to bring back Alienating the Audience. I have former Representative Dan Maffei on. We're going to talk about Star Trek and the Orville. But before we do any of that, we have to pay those bills, don't we? Which means a word from our sponsor. Something's Off with Andrew Heaton is brought to you by Up Machines Unlimited, proud manufacturers of the Jumbo Elevator. If you're like me, you love elevators, but you hate how cramped they are, particularly if you work with a lot of fat people. Sure, you can take the stairs like a peasant, or convince your boss to install a fire pole. Good luck with that. Personally, I have a stipulation in my contract that I never have to walk more than two flights of stairs without a court order. But wouldn't it be amazing if there was a more spacious, deluxe option available? Well, good news. Up Machines Unlimited makes a jumbo elevator that will be a welcome relief to your business or residence. Each three-deck jumbo elevator spans 26 feet and three stories, and it can hold up to 480 people. No more breathing down Tom from accounting's neck with the other office sardines in the morning. No more knowing the exact brand of deodorant Susan from HR uses because your head is involuntarily thrust into her armpit. She's very tall. With a jumbo elevator, there's more than enough space to go around. That's because you're standing in the business class of elevators, my friend. Now, because a jumbo elevator is so much more spacious than the diminutive, cramped death box you probably squeeze into at your office, it goes without saying that it operates at a reduced pace. Usually, about 12 minutes per floor, give or take. There are trade-offs in life, and you can either have a big, slow, luxurious elevator or a fast, tiny one apparently designed for elves. You know what? You won't even care that your jumbo elevator takes a little over an hour to get to the sixth floor of the building. Because on the second level of the jumbo elevator, there's a big screen TV, a dry bar, and a friggin' hot tub. Now, if you work on the 30th floor of a building, that does mean roughly 6 hours of commute time from ground to drop-off. But not to worry, because the third level of a jumbo elevator has multiple fully functional workstations with power outlets and free Wi-Fi. By the time you get to work, you'll have already done it. The Jumbo Elevator by Up Machines Unlimited. Breathing room for the upwardly mobile. And before we get to my guest, it's time for another installment of How To with Heaton. This week, I'm going to teach you how to train a dog. The thing to remember about dogs is that they want to please you, particularly depending on the breed. As much as a handful as, say, Labrador Retriever puppies are, they are desperate to spend time with you and earn your affection. Let's take the dog I'm fostering, Lassie. Lassie is a Border Collie, just like her namesake, and Border Collies are very intelligent, and they learn very easily, but that incredible intelligence also comes with some downsides. Here's the issue we're going through at my house. I want to train my foster dog Lassie to go fetch the newspaper every morning, but instead, she goes out and tries to drown my neighbor's kid. Now, as you can imagine, this is a pretty big hassle every day. There I am, bumbling around my kitchen in slippers and a crumpled smoking jacket, and the peace of the morning is shattered by a 9-year-old screaming for help. Then I have to go outside and break him up, and when Timmy's parents inevitably come out, I have to pretend I have no idea whose dog it is dragging a kid across 12 lawns. Whoa, whose border collie is that keeps trying to drown Timmy? That's what I say, just shouting at the neighborhood in general. But after the sixth or seventh attempt at drowning, I have to think people are beginning to suspect Lassie is my dog. And that's going to be awkward at the next barbecue. So what I've been doing is giving Lassie a treat whenever she doesn't try to drown Timmy. That's positive reinforcement. And you can do this at home too. A lot of dogs are so desperate for your attention that they jump up on you. Which, if they're bigger, can be a little exhausting, right? The thing is, the dog doesn't know what down, don't jump, down means. It's just gobbledygook to him. Just like when I shout, Lassie, bad dog, don't drown Timmy. Bad, bad dog, no drowning. She doesn't know what that means. I'm just shouting. In both instances, the dogs are getting what they want. Attention. So when your dog jumps up, just nudge it off and ignore it. If you respond positively or negatively, you're incentivizing the dog to jump on you again. Another important thing is to make sure that your dog has sufficient stimulus. In my case, I figured I would take Lassie on a morning and evening walk, but otherwise just let her chill in my backyard. That's not enough mental activity for a curious, energetic 2-year-old border collie. Which is probably why she dug up that abandoned well in the lot behind the Wilson's house. Even though there's a pond a half mile away, she passes that every day. It seems kind of weird that she passes a pond on the way to the well, which, as I think I mentioned, she tries to drown my neighbor's kid in. I'm not sure what that's about. Anyway, a lot of the time when your dog is playing, it'll get kind of nippy with you, even though it's harmless. You don't want to encourage that, of course. What a lot of people do is, and I've done this, when the dog nips at you, yelp and pretend you're in pain. Your dog doesn't want to hurt you, so it'll feel bad and it'll quit being so nippy. Similarly, in Lassie's case, what I've been doing is taking a bath and screaming a lot. Just screaming and screaming. Oh God, I shout. This is horrible. This is so horrible. People shouldn't be in water. Don't put people in water. Then you know what happens? That goofy old dog jumps right in and tries to take a bath with me. They're funny animals, all right. And I wouldn't have it any other way. Back by popular demand, it is Alienating the Audience, where I geek out on sci-fi with an interesting guest. And today, my interesting guest is Dan Maffei. He is a former congressman from New York, George Washington University professor, and presently a commissioner of the Federal Maritime Commission. Welcome, Commissioner. Thank you for coming on.
Yeah, great. And all that doesn't qualify me at all to talk about science fiction.
But,
let's do it anyway.
I went through our email chain, and you are clearly qualified to talk about science fiction, because we emailed you and we went, hey, what are a couple episodes that you think would be fun to discuss? And you sent back a minor thesis on, nine different Star Trek episodes, and then you kind of like started going, I really like the original series, and you started giving me your thoughts on Voyager and Deep Space Nine, and then how that ties into the Orville. So you clearly are in the camp of people that know their science fiction.
But as long as nobody who knows my wife listens to that, that's fine.
I didn't want to say anything, but about 30% of my listeners are Mrs. Maffei. So we'll make sure not to get you into any trouble beyond that.
Right. Well, and actually, she didn't change her name, so I won't even tell you what her name is. That way, I know that.
Then Mrs. Maffei must be your mom. Okay, I'm going to talk to my producer about the stats there. So actually, the one that I wanted to talk to you about initially, we'll probably kind of wander in this, but the thing that caught my eye in the back and forth email that you and I had was you mentioned off the cuff that you like the Orville, and you mentioned an episode called Majority Rule, and I watched it last night, and I thought it was great fodder for conversation and probably more relevant to the period we're living in than, say, like the original series. So can you walk us through what the Orville is in terms of Star Trek?
Well, look, I do want to talk about Star Trek. I feel the Orville can't admit it, but it is Star Trek. I mean, obviously, they don't have the rights to any of the intellectual property, but Seth MacFarlane, who is a self-described Star Trek and science fiction fan, put this together. I don't think there's any question it would never have happened without him being mainly behind it. I think that the Orville is far closer to what Star Trek would have looked like had it come out today, the original series or even the Next Generation come out today, then, certainly the movies and the Discovery series, which is completely serialized. So yeah. I do think, that it gives us a good sense of where it is. And one of those things is talking about contemporary problems, which Majority Rule does, I think, very well. It got terrible reviews from the people who review these things. And I just think that they were missing the point, or maybe they just don't appreciate that kind of observation.
Yeah, I liked the episode. I have mixed thoughts on the Orville. Part of it is because I am such a dedicated Star Trek fan, I feel a sense of protectiveness and propriety over the series. So when I first started watching the Orville, I went, "Hey, this is a knockoff," and I'm kind of there's a part of me that recoils from it because it seems. It seems like they're.
I might agree with you. Had the thing whole thing not been sold to CBS, I mean, it's become a commodity long ago.
Yeah.
So I know that Eugene Roddenberry, who I think is the son of the original Gene Roddenberry, is involved in
Discovery. Oh, really?
Discovery.
Okay. Roddenberry.
There is a little bit. Well, no, that's Discovery. So I think that your argument holds a little bit of water there. Mm-hmm. But let's face it, CBS is a profit-making operation.
And, yeah.
They'll go as far. So look, I think it's sort of both have a right to be sort of in that. And both, by the way, I do think I like Orville better as a rep- representation of Star Trek for a variety of reasons. Mm-hmm. Discovery, I find very entertaining. It doesn't seem very Star Trek to what I thought Star Trek was when I was growing up. And of course, mm-hmm. It's exactly when I was born was when the original series was going on. So, some of it is my own generational bias, but I'm glad they both exist.
Yeah. I haven't worked my way through Discovery yet. I will do so eventually. I was initially bothered by it because they've redesigned the Klingons a third time, and I feel like two Klingon models is enough.
They redesigned them, in my view, in a very poor way. They made them far more two-dimensional than they were, in my view. I mean, they try to do things here and there, and they have conflict between them. Mm-hmm. They have this weird skin color thing, which just bothers me. I think they're not being careful enough about some of the things that they're doing.
Vulcans can telepathically communicate across the galaxy, which has never been done before and would have altered.
You've got to go to a whole different level of complete, imagination to get. I mean, they have something called the spore drive, which essentially they take a bunch of mushroom spores and put it in there. Engines, and somehow that allows them to jump anywhere in the galaxy. So, look, they take a lot of liberties, and that's one of the reasons why I do say, look, the Orville has as much right to be there as anyone else. And if you're a Star Trek fan, you definitely want to, let the fact that it's not the canon. Mm-hmm. It is, I think, in very many ways, very close to the spirit of it. And look, that's what Majority Rule is. It's one episode. It's episodic. So, mm-hmm. So much of Discovery is all serialized, but right. This is episodic, that it can take one episode and examine a cultural phenomenon going on right now in the United States, and do it in such a way, it simplifies it tremendously. But I think that shows you, what's going on in our democracy in a way that is very, very relevant.
I agree with you there. It's true to kind of the original series in that regard, where in the original series, they'd occasionally time travel back to the 50s or the 60s, and they deal with something. And then there's a lot of episodes where they're also dealing with a contemporary issue within themselves. Where they're the half white half black guy that's fighting the half black half white guy.
Let that be your last battlefield. Yeah.
So they are grappling.
Absolutely. And the thing is, and this is why I don't understand some of the reviews, are these people who didn't like Star Trek initially that are reviewing. And maybe it is, because not only do they go back in time in the Star Trek, but they go to planets and they reproduce, some sort of historical thing. So Patterns of Force is a very famous one where they go back and they go to a different planet and an anthropologist landed there and tried to introduce the good parts of Nazi Germany, whatever that was.
Oh, right,
and
yeah. Snappy uniforms. They did have very snappy uniforms. You got to give them that. Hugo Boss did a fine job.
Yeah, exactly. There's an episode which is very, very entertaining, one of my favorites, called A Piece of the Action, where they go to a planet where somebody inadvertently left a book on gangsters, and the planet had a very a culture that imitated the entire thing and created an entire planet full of gangsters and Abe Vigoda made a good appearance there. So look, they do this all the time in mm-hmm. the original series, and that's why this seems so much the same. And the complaints, that could never happen, or it's too much like Earth, when something said that. I hope everybody knows. I mean, basically what it is they land on a planet and the planet's very much like Earth is today, today in the 21st century, except everybody wears a little badge that says how many likes and dislikes they have. Mm. And everything is decided essentially by likes and dislikes. It's direct democracy gone crazy. And it obviously leads to all sorts of fun, and I won't make it no spoilers, but that being able to examine that in such a way is something the Orville can do that the rest of Star Trek right now can't, because they're stuck in this, they never do episodic. I mean, most of the series, after the original series did, episodic, and then sometimes they would do an extended.
Yeah, like Deep Space Nine, kind of in the last three seasons, Deep Space Nine gets into the Dominion War, kind of from the Klingon War on, which I enjoyed that. I do like that, and I loved Battlestar Galactica for that reason. I
like it too. They can go back and forth, and it's the success of Battlestar Galactica and things like Game of Thrones, and also which is why CBS, which is trying to create its own Netflix, has gone to that. But I think it's important to still have something, you know, like the Orville.
Yeah, no, I think you're right about that, because the, I mean, the upshot to having a serialized program is that it does have, I think, a much better plot, and you can have characterization that kind of unspools in a longer time frame, and so it's a more fulfilling, rewarding experience from a plot. But if you want to explore topical issues, episodic's probably a better format for that, because you don't have to be hung up on the same thing permanently. You can, you know, they can. TNG and TOS were really good for that. Where they beam down to a planet and go, oh, this is an interesting place. And then they beam back up and go, we all learned a valuable lesson today. And then, you know, go off to the next adventure.
That's Kirk. No. Okay. Just trying to get your English accent.
That's it. That was my Picard attempt with very little.
No, I know.
Don't
ask me to do any of them. I could do Spock's eyebrow on a good day. But look, I think you're absolutely right. The thing, though, the part of my problem, though, with Discovery, you know, when you sort of see it, is that they don't do a lot of character development. To the extent they do, you know, then they kind of throw a lot of that away. You'll sort of see what I mean. So I don't know. I have my own issues with that program. I do think it's worth a watch for a Star Trek fan. But
yeah,
I've got, actually, speaking of Picard, I've got better hopes, higher hopes.
Oh, yeah, definitely for me. I'll ask you about that in a minute, because I'm I am bothered by how much of my happiness is hinging on how good Picard is. I will really, in the same way that, like, my favorite sports team losing the Super Bowl and then, like, being dissolved as a team, that's how I will feel if Picard is not good. So we'll talk about that in a minute, but I will stick with the majority rule for right now. I think you're right. It's a very good episode. It's actually, I think it came out about coterminously with a very similar Black Mirror episode. So if you watch Black Mirror at home, there's two that kind of straddle that, but there's one that has Ron Howard's daughter in it, who is the lady protagonist from Jurassic World, and it's kind of a similar concept where there's been this merger of credit ratings and social media profiles, to where they're one and the same thing. You know, you've got certain credit rating, which seems crazy, but it's actually literally being implemented in China right now. I mean, that is the plan. Is they've already, I think they haven't completely rolled it out, but it's sort of in beta testing at the moment, to the point where there are people that can't leave the country anymore because their social media scores, as determined by the state, are too low. So they are suspect citizens. So it's a really thing happening right now.
It's really interesting that you'd bring that up, because I'm sorry, but you know, I do have my background in politics and government, and when I do look at these things, you know, you sort of see one of the things that I really liked about the episode, and I think it's, is that Nosedive, a Black Mirror episode? Anyway,
I think Nosedive is the one where we're with Ron Howard's daughter. Yeah,
right. So you're looking at this, and on the surface, it looks like democracy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody, you know, well, you get everybody deciding. It looks like capitalism in terms of the credit rating, and it looks like freedom. But the truth is, it's not. It's actually the opposite of it. You cannot have Western liberalism with pure majority opinion, particularly when it's as uninformed as it is in these things. But you can have communism. And the interesting thing about the technology that you have today, they didn't have that, you know, through the Soviet period. But you can have sort of, well, we'll just take a pulse of what everybody thinks at that moment, and that will be the absolute truth. It's very, very problematic. And I don't know, maybe just nobody else is getting that from these things, but I certainly do. And that's, you know, it's a huge mistake to equate, well, a majority of people think something with that means that's right. Or even that means we should follow that.
I completely agree with you. And it's comparing our situation to China's situation, I think, is almost like comparing Aldous Huxley to George Orwell, where entertainment is this largely kind of obscuring phenomenon where you don't have to think, because you can be the recipient of media coming at you all the time. And we're obsessed with the Cardassians. I have to be careful in alienating the episode. Not Kardashians. Cardassians.
Exactly.
We're obsessed with them. But whereas in China, though, it's much more Orwellian, where it is this tool of the state to force compliance and ensure that everybody is operating in the same capacity. And I'm with you too. It's also
you could combine the Kardashians and the Cardassians and just have an alien race that has all these bumps on their head, but then they have them removed.
I would totally watch a show called Keeping Up with the Kardashians. If Star Trek
would be interesting.
Like, you're watching reality television from the Star Trek universe, I would watch that. I'm with you too. Plus the
but I get your point.
Well, and like what we have that China doesn't have, and that I think has been what we have inherited, and I think we take for granted in Western civilization, particularly here in the United States, because this didn't happen in France, is that we have always had a sort of appreciation for there's majority rule, but there's also individual rights. So there's only the majority determines the course of certain laws, but there is a barrier at which we no longer allow majoritarianism to inform people. You don't get to determine what somebody's religion is. You don't get to determine what they're allowed to say and that kind of thing. And that's there's no actual reason they have to go hand in hand. That's either very brilliant planning or historical accident that we've struck onto. But you look at like the French Revolution, it's just sheer majoritarianism. There was no concept of individual rights.
Well, it was during the Reign of Terror. It was. I mean, I think that's the thing that we don't want to. That I think it's sort of hard to admit is that most of the brutal dictatorships do come to power through some sort of election.
Right.
But this is what I think we're kind of losing today. I mean, particularly with the internet. The internet is seemingly this great democratic device, but it's small d democratic. But it's this direct democracy. First of all, it's so fast, it's uninformed. A variety of reasons why that really messes everything up. But even so, even if you sort of ignore that for a second, you're having these instantaneous judgments. And you sort of see this all the time, on various forums, which I have to admit, they don't go on very often. But you do see these sort of like, well, you know, majority of people believe this, therefore we have to take it seriously. And you see it in science all the time, too. So majority, so many people, climate change, I don't like these arguments that say, well, 95 or 98% of scientists say climate change is real. Mm-hmm. Why don't I like that? Because I don't care if 3% say it's real, if it's real.
Yeah.
Right.
Well,
if it's experimentally true, don't get into a majoritarian argument, because that's irrelevant. It's irrelevant how many scientists say it's true if it can be proven scientifically. And the same thing, GMOs cause some damage to your health. Enough people now think this that, it becomes quote unquote true, even if there's no scientific evidence. And it goes on and on, the vaccine thing.
And it's contrary to the whole idea of the scientific revolution. Like a major portion of the scientific revolution is that we don't have deference to authority. That there's if you're a priest or you're a scientist, you don't get higher intellectual ranking. It's based on the veracity of your argument. Yeah, I agree with you. When I see those kind of numbers floating around, I think that they're oftentimes a red herring and can do more of a problem there. I'm on the note of total democracy. I'm curious for your experience, because you've been a congressman twice.
I borrowed a Republican district for a couple terms.
Right, as I recall, you came in and then you lost, but then you came back. You've been through the electoral rung a couple of times. The idea of total democracy? Let me rephrase it. Coming into Congress and leaving Congress, what did you think of how well-informed constituents are, and what did you think of the general intelligence of your peers? Did you come in with a positive perspective? Did you leave with a positive perspective?
So the first thing first. So, right. So part of my challenge was, and the reason why I have such a roller coaster kind of electoral career is because the electorate was so different in my district between presidential and non-presidential years. I came from an upstate New York district, leaned Republican a little bit in terms of the registration, but a lot in terms of the sort of institutions, very weak local Democratic Party, but a very strong Republican base. And so I had to sort of build an apparatus every time. The issue, and nobody cared about the governor's race or the senator's races, because those were all going to be downstate or somebody from New York City. So in an off year, it was very difficult to get anybody to turn out. In an on year, particularly in the years where Obama was on the ticket, it was much easier. So with enough of a turnout, I was able to win. And so you have these strange kind of things where like, well, is it the voters don't like me, then like me, then don't like me, then like me? Or is it that they're different voters?
Hmm.
When you ask, are the voters are informed? I think misinformation is sort of rampant, but it's not that people are stupid. It's that people really are getting different sets of facts. I worked for the late, great Daniel Patrick Moynihan, whose birthday was 2 days ago. We're still alive.
That would be the senator from New York who had quite a lot of gravitas and respect behind him. Yeah,
right, as sort of an intellectual professor who became a senator. And wouldn't happen today. But he was fond of saying that people are, and I'm butchering the quote a little bit, but the principle is the same, that people are entitled to their own opinion, but not their own set of facts.
Right.
Today, I actually think, and I know you've had guests on that sort of talked about it, that people actually are not as different in values as I think one would think if they just watch the media, particularly the media in Washington all the time. But they're getting different sets of facts. And so if you believe that set of facts, they're getting overwhelmed with information. And so they do the best they can in a very short amount of time when they're not, they have to raise their families and work for a living. And some people have several jobs. They don't have time to follow all this stuff and get their own set of facts. So they have to believe somebody. So they believe either Fox News or MSNBC, or maybe they believe in NPR or whatever, or a podcast, right? But the point at the end of the day is that they're going to end up misinformed. Not because they're stupid, but just because all of those different media now have some sort of core interest.
Yeah, I could see
that. So actually, the weird thing is the people who are the most engaged in politics tend to be the ones who watch the more biased stuff on both the left and the right. So for a primary election, forget about it. You know, it's going to be one set of truth. And if you can't really challenge that if you want any chance at all. And that's the unfortunate thing. And that's what's going on right now in the presidential election is, it's a race to the left or the populist left for the Democrats. And I think that's on. Yeah, I feel the same, feel the same way. It'll give the president a real chance.
That is my fear. I won't go too far into the Trump topic today, but I really do not want the Democrats to lurch hard left. I certainly don't want them to go socialist or populist leftist. And I'm afraid that might be the lightning rod that they wind up gathering around. And then it's Trump versus extreme economically progressive populist. And it'll further that division.
But I caution you a little bit. Who knows what the person really will be all about? That's just the image.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the sad thing about politics is that it's become more and more just for show. Mm-hmm. Who knows what the real candidates are? Just like who knows a lot of things what the president does. I've heard you on this program talk about, you don't support the president, but then he takes a stand on something like prison reform.
Or
whatever, recidivism and stuff. I feel the same way. I mean, I support a lot of this. Trade policies and other kinds of things. Of course, I work at I still work in the federal government, and although I'm a Democrat on a commission, it's bipartisan. But so am I supposed to say, well, I disagree with him now, or I agree with him, but I'm going to disagree with him because he's Trump? No, of course not.
Yeah.
I don't know where he really is. I can tell you this: when I was running as a long shot candidate for the House against a very popular incumbent, somebody who I have a tremendous amount of respect for. Then and now, but it's running against him at no chance at all. Donald Trump supported me. Why did Donald Trump support me? Well, because I was a Democrat who was critical of trade agreements, wanted to renegotiate NAFTA, and was critical of the war in Iraq.
Really? Okay.
I never met him, but I was on that list. So, I don't know. So that's the thing is, I don't know what you're really going to get. I don't know what the heart of hearts is of the nominee you get, but yes, they're going to play to the
And I suspect one of the other phenomena that I'm quite bothered by, because I'm fighting this impulse, is I think that voting is now becoming a kind of religious statement rather than an attempt to solve problems. I view politics as problem solving, so I'm trying to look at what is the policy angle of the particular candidate, and do I think they can enact that? But I think now it's more of like I am expressing the group identity and who I want to be Pope. And so it kind of becomes this referendum on the values and personality of the candidate, which I would ideally want to have some play, but not be the top one.
I don't disagree with you. I'm just not sure if it's ever been that different.
Yeah, that's true. I'm probably glamorized.
Well, when we're talking about Star Trek, and the fact is that a lot. You look at the '60s, and they came up with this idea of a Vulcan, of Spock, and what is Spock? And, this is a guy who, has no religion, but he does have rituals and he does have all these things. And what is that, what is it all dedicated to? It's dedicated to getting rid of emotions and logic.
Yeah.
The fact is that we, whether we even know it or not, almost all of us vote on emotions. Mm. And that is what the candidates are playing to. And they're not playing to it, by the way, because they want to. You asked a question that I didn't mean to pass up, which is, what did I think of my colleagues? And I have to tell you, I thought my colleagues were terrific for the most part. Some of them were less informed than others, but all of them brought some important thing to the table. But I have to tell you that they were stuck in a world where they had to play to a certain constituency in order to have any chance of re-election. And it was increasingly so. First, the Republicans were threatened by primaries, and then now finally the Democrats are too. And almost every member, I was not in this category, but you know, members from 80 to 90% of the districts, they weren't worried about a challenge from the other party. They were worried about a challenge from their own party.
Yeah. I that makes total sense to me. I worked for Tim Holden, who probably overlapped with you, from Pennsylvania, and Dan Boren, both Blue Dogs. And Dan ended up leaving, but Tim got redistricted, and then he got a challenge from the left and then got knocked out from there. So he was more worried about a primary and was right to be more worried about a primary than he was of a general.
No, absolutely. No, absolutely. I know them both well. And the thing with like Dan retiring is, you know, I talked to him, and like, what do you do when you really don't have a place in either party? And how can you
start
ask
a podcast?
To make the sacrifices? Yeah, well, I guess, yeah, you know, maybe he should, but it'd be competition for you. But you know, exactly. And also once they got rid of things like earmarks, and you know, earmarks were just the easy target. There's a lot of these kind of things. There's actually very little you can do for your district. Anyway, I don't want to get too far off on politics because I may actually be qualified to speak about that, but Star Trek.
Yeah, much better. Well, actually, hold on. So before I lose the point, I want to go back to specifically majority rule, just because there's a couple more things. We talked about the kind of like oppressive Orwellian element to it of, you know, a statist system where you're being graded on your social media score. But the other thing that they also struck onto, which is much more American, is this kind of what I view is almost like a daily or weekly impulse to throw someone in a volcano. I feel like we have, I think this is a tribal thing that we've got that everybody has this. I think it's a basic human thing where we need to have somebody to hate. And we had somebody to hate in the Cold War and in World War II. And then absent that external foe, we sort of went, I guess I hate you. And now we sort of, it's like, I get the impression that the internet wakes up every day and is just sort of looking for someone to say or do something bad and then go after them and ruin them. And I thought that the episode was very good at glomming onto that, of that kind of group pylon of let's drag the guy out in front of the masses and then, you know, do a witch trial and hang him.
No, I think that's right. You know, it's one of those things where, you know, a psychologist might sort of say, you got to find somebody to hate or you're going to hate yourself, right? So whatever you could do, you know, find somebody who could be the scapegoat. And it's certainly true in politics, perhaps always been, but certainly today. And, you know, it was true on that episode, and that's exactly it. And I think I'm trying to remember where they go, but it's one of those things where, like, even once you get the sense that even once they diffuse their hatred for a particular person, that's possible, but then they're going to go to the next person to hate. And you know, you sort of see that. And, you know, it's
Well, and just to get back to politics a little bit, were you, I think I would be afraid, I think I would live in fear of stepping in it if I were in public office right now, for fear of saying the wrong thing and having that group pile on. Trump would be a fairly good counterexample to somebody that can survive that with very little ramifications. But was that something that you were worried about when you were in office, that all of a sudden there'd be like a Twitter bomb surrounding you?
Yeah, I guess. I think we have to worry about it now. I mean, you have to worry about it in everyday life almost now, which is the thing with the internet. But yes, particularly in public office. Again, you know, the thing with public office, you've always been under scrutiny and you could always say something that would screw you up. But now you could say it a lot faster. In fact, you know, I don't know if you're going to believe me for saying that, right? I mean, it is one of those things where you always have to watch it. Even Donald Trump does. He just doesn't have to watch it with the same constituency that you or I may have to watch it. And I think that is the sort of thing. And by the way, that's where that anti-politically correctness sort of comes from. It's not all, you know, there's a reason to be nervous about, once you get to a point of political correctness where it's not, you know, it's sort of no longer voluntary. It's no longer, I care about your feelings, so I'm going to try to word things in a way that don't offend you and include you. That's fine. But it's a whole other thing where you can't say that at all.
Right.
Right. You can't even think it.
You've committed heresy.
At that point, you've committed heresy, downvotes, downvotes, downvotes. And at that point, then I think, you know, you can't have a society anymore. There is such a thing as too much freedom of speech. And if you don't believe me, go back and read Jefferson, go back and read Madison. You know, Jefferson was furious at Adams for passing signing the Alien and Sedition Acts.
Yeah.
But part of his reasoning was the states should be doing that, not the federal government.
Really?
So right? Regulate speech.
Jefferson would have been okay with constrictions on speech so long as it was happening on a state
level? I don't think that far on the state level, but the states, he didn't see the Constitution at that point as prohibiting the states. So he wouldn't have seen it as a constitutional issue.
Okay.
And, you know, that's part of what's going on in today is, I think, you know, we've, again, it's this sort of extreme, you know, this extreme form of democracy, which we see in you know, the Orville's episode.
Yeah.
This extreme form of freedom of speech where anybody can say anything without any repercussion, true or not true, et cetera. Those are the kinds of things that, that are dangerous.
Well, so can you unpack that for me? Because I watched that episode and I see a culture that's very anti-freedom of speech in that, point there's, I really enjoyed the scene. They didn't make much out of it, but I thought it was cool where I can't remember the character's name because I don't know the Orville as well, but the young lady that's very clearly an alien on the crew, who's not a homo sapien, she has on a hat in order to obscure her alien features, and a guy comes up and he goes, "Hey, like you're not Kelvin, you can't wear that." And there's this sort of like mini proxy for cultural appropriation that I thought was fun. Now we don't know the background of that, and I'd say with cultural appropriation, for me, the kind of the delineating factor is if you're taking something that a group of people find sacred and you're demeaning it, I understand why they're offended. If it's just, "Hey, like, you know, dreadlocks are for Jamaicans and you're not Jamaican," then I see it as kind of creating this sort of like racial cultural ghettos, which I don't like at all. So I don't know where that would have been in that universe. But nonetheless, though, it seemed to me that was a realm that you needed to be very worried about saying things in. And I saw that as being sort of caustic and suppressory to freedom of speech. In what way do you think it was an extreme form of freedom of speech?
I think that's right. I think both are dangerous. I mean, and I think that's the thing is you can't, it's easy to just go to a simple extreme and sort of say, well, you know, we have to be completely politically correct and can't offend anybody, or on the other side, you know, you can say anything you want anytime, whatever, even anonymously, which has always been done. But I think that, pointing out those kind of dangers, and also sort of how it's kind of how insidious they are. They can kind of sneak up on you and you sort of see that on the program.
Yeah.
I mean, look, one of the most interesting things about it is if you really sort of think about this idea of, collective yesing and knowing, it's not, first of all, it's not new to the Star Trek universe again. Asterisk, that Orville isn't in it. Bread and Circuses in the original series had something very similar.
Oh, yeah, there's a bunch of great episodes we're going to have the humans fight each other, and yeah, there's a lot of them.
Right, exactly. So, you have that kind of thing. But also, one scholar has actually made an interesting comparison, it sounds a bit of a stretch, but at least it's fodder for thought. It's a guy named Brent McDonald, I think it was a book called Star Trek in History, made an analogy between Facebook and the Borg.
Oh.
Now, where do we get this from? Well, if you think about it, it gets back to my point about, how if you have absolute democracy and then you have a centralized system, which can be accomplished through the internet or a variety of other technological ways. You know, if you have if you have collective thought, which we're coming close to having in our society today, and then you can enforce that some way, you have the Borg. And I think it's important to sort of look at the Borg in this light of current technology. I'd love to see one of these series, and obviously that it would have to be canon Star Trek to actually have the Borg itself, but look at that in terms of, who exactly are the Borg? Because the Borg were not this, sort of evil species. What they are is it's sort of pure communism or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's this collective thought, and it is not that different. So seemingly, again, you know, what looks like seemingly capitalism gone amok ends up being, and democracy, you know, sort of full democracy, full-fledged democracy, ends up getting twisted to become the opposite of itself.
That is definite food for thought. The idea of the Borg is Facebook. I hope the Orville does an episode like that, where there is a assimilating cyborg species that also appears to be Twitter. That would be phenomenal. Well, before we're going to wrap up.
They did have this season. They did have kind of Borg like species, but they were individuals, and actually the fact that they were individuals is why they didn't end up taking over. So that's not exactly.
Well, and I'll say one of the things that I do like about the Orville that I think is in the original series, there's a very heady dose of Cold War ideas, and there's definitely a clear there's bad guys and good guys. There's a kind of morality there. If you watch The Twilight Zone, there's almost like a pervasive, constant paranoia that society's going to break down and you're going to have to fight your neighbors, or that we're all going to be atomized. And one of the things I like about the Orville is that it does seem to have this kind of all-present nervousness that we all have now in the panopticon of the 21st century, that we are worried about, stepping in the digital bear trap and being ruined by a mob. I thought that the episode did a very good job of capturing that.
Yeah, no, I think so too. Though I will say this, I think one of the things about the Orville that makes it a little, at least for me, closer to the mood of the original Star Trek than Discovery, is that it isn't completely dark. That, the original Star Trek may have had these morality plays and gone to dark planets and dealt with big issues, but at the end of the day, they would come back to the ship and they would say, we figured out a way to live together. We figured out, a way for people to celebrate our differences and to get along and, not follow, even though they didn't, most of them didn't get rid of emotion like the Vulcans did, still not have it dominate us, to sort of have this sort of control. And I see that in the Orville too. You still see the parties, you still see, them having lots of diversity, a liquid being played by Norm MacDonald. I mean, fun stuff like that. And sort of this sense of, you can be whatever you want to be, that sort of thing. Whereas, Discovery is just pure war all the time. I mean, you're just, fighting for survival constantly.
Yeah, so you're getting into that dark realm.
Yeah, exactly. So I it's two sides of the same coin, maybe, but I think you're right in that they go look at dark things, but there is this sort of sense of ultimate optimism, which I appreciate, actually. I might probably sound pretty gloomy in this interview, but the truth is that I do think that people are pretty,
I'm in my mid-30s right now, and I find that...
When you say that, is there always a fanfare?
That was, I think they thought that I was wrapping up, but I've actually got a couple more questions for you before we do that. I was about to say that in my 30s now, I am increasingly Lockean and less Hobbesian. I do think that people are the vast majority of people are cooperative and supportive and want to help. I think we're living in a time where we're hyper cognizant of the baddies. We're very aware of them, but I think that overall most people are good. We're moving in a positive direction. There are problems, but I'm still buying green bananas. So before we head out, I do want to ask you real quick, what do you think Picard will look like, the forthcoming series? What are your hopes for it, and what are you worried about?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, they keep on pointing out, that it's going to be different than anything else.
You sound very skeptical of that.
Well, no. Actually, if it is going to be different than anything else, how can anybody predict what it is, right? So if they're right, then you can't predict it. And if they're wrong, then look, I think Patrick Stewart is interesting, and to give him more of a say, because, he had an increasing say, but he's never really, he's sort of done all these movies. They've all been more scripted, at least it's my sense. Mm-hmm. Not like when they eventually gave Leonard Nimoy the keys to the castle with Star Trek III and Star Trek IV. So if they're doing that with Patrick Stewart, I just think it'll be very, very interesting. Obviously a very, very strong character. I do hope that if they serialize it, they don't so completely serialize it that, you're stuck in this, kind of endless war with, shifting characters and, we're going to surprise you just like Game of Thrones does in the next episode, kind of thing with Discovery. I mean, I know why they do that, but I'm hoping that they can be a little more intellectual with Picard
Yeah, you know, I have great hopes for it. The one concern I have, because I know that when Patrick Stewart announced they were doing it, he had some statement that said something to the effect of, in these troubled times, we need a strong leader who will come. And I think he's referring to Trump, that like Trump is on the one hand, it's like, I didn't realize if we voted for Trump that we would get Patrick Stewart playing Picard again. That's actually a cool side benefit to the Trump presidency. But my fear with it is that it will turn into a series wide resolution on Donald Trump. And I really don't want Star Trek to do that. I would be very, even if I agreed with the political angle that they had on it, I don't want it to become yet another Trump-centric conversation. So I'm hoping that there's not a ham-fisted allegory with the president. But I haven't heard a lot about that, so my fears are being slowly allayed.
No, I agree. I mean, I think, the whole news media is obsessed with Trump. They created, in many ways, they created Trump.
Oh, yeah.
Donald Trump evolved his campaign or whatever. I don't know how much credit you want to give him personally or not, but his campaign evolved to take advantage of the political forces and and take all that stuff, and whatever the media complains about him, they love him. I think you pointed that out in the past. Les Moonves, late of CBS, said he was the best thing that ever happened to CBS, maybe better than Star Trek, who knows. So it would be bad to combine them. I do think Star Trek offers it's sort of this weird kind of contradiction. It's an escape that allows you to think about the problems that we do have in the world in a fresh light. And I definitely don't want it to become such an allegory for what's going on currently that you don't get that. I don't think so. I'm gonna lay it on the line here. I trust these people enough that they won't make it totally about this person. I hope that Hollywood, or that part of Hollywood, is not so obsessed that they can't get out of their own way on that. Because, love him, hate him, or anything in between, President Trump is one president.
Star Trek is bigger than Trump.
One chapter. Exactly.
I think you've put your thumb on it. I think that's ultimately Star Trek is an escape that allows us from that happy escaped place to go back and observe things, and I hope it maintains that. I will end it there, Commissioner, just because we're running out the clock. But I have greatly enjoyed talking to you. Thank you for running the gambit of the Orville Star Trek and politics with me, and come back on again.
It is a sneaky way to talk about politics.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ann.
All right, tad bit of listener feedback before we leave. Alan says on iTunes, in a world where national news always has an agenda and is run from shadow organizations, this podcast gives it to you straight. That's right. This podcast is the hard news that other ones are refusing to do, just like today. Remember, you can always tweet me at Mighty Heaton or Facebook me at facebook.com/MightyHeaton, or even email me by subscribing to my newsletter at MightyHeaton.com and just replying when I send it out on Fridays, like I did last Friday when I remembered. Good job, me. I'd also like to encourage you to subscribe to Blaze TV and download the Blaze TV app. If you do, you can watch me instead of just listening to me. Use the promo code Heaton to get $10 off your annual Blaze TV subscription. So download the Blaze TV app on iTunes or Google Play, get subscribed to The Blaze, and then fall in love with me more than you already are. You can also watch portions of the show on Facebook Watch by going to facebook.com/HeatonTV. Finally, please subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. Ask yourself this: how many comedians are talking to former congressmen about Star Trek? That is a small niche there, guys. So subscribe, rate, and review. That helps other people discover that conversation in this here political orphanage. Thank you, and good day.